Welcome to the Celebrity Estates Wills of the Rich and Famous podcast. In this podcast, we break down high-profile celebrity estate planning cases for advisors and their clients. Most celebrity estate catastrophes are based on the same issues that everyday people face, just with the volume turned up. Our goal is to identify and extract the individual estate planning issues that lie at the heart of each story. We then discuss what advisors should expect and how to avoid common pitfalls. Hosted by WealthManagement.com senior editor David Lenock.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of WealthManagement.com's Celebrity Estates, Wills of the Rich and Famous. For anyone new to the podcast, in each installment, myself and a guest take on a different celebrity estate and attempt to extract some key lessons that planners can apply to their more traditional clients. The idea being that celebrity estate planning stories, although often ridiculous in their details, generally have at their cores very basic issues that can just as easily apply to non-famous or fabulously wealthy clients. Our guest this week is Alvina Lowe. She's the Chief Wealth Strategist at Wilmington Trust. Alvina is responsible for wealth planning, family office services, and thought leadership development for Wilmington Trust's wealth management division. She oversees a national team of wealth strategists, family office services professionals, and thought leadership experts who together serve as advisors to high net individuals and families, business owners, entrepreneurs, and foundations. Thanks so much for joining us, Alvina.
Well, thank you for having me, David.
So now that I've already told you what we normally do on this show, today's episode is going to be a bit different, where we would usually use a single wealthy celebrity to sort of launch our conversation about planning in general. This time, we're going to focus on a group of wealthy families who are less famous, but whose cooperative efforts create a singular entity that is arguably more famous than any celebrity, and that is the National Football League. Amidst the glitz and glamour of the recent Super Bowl and the current furor of the beginning of free agency, a quieter yet crucial aspect that often escapes the spotlight is that the NFL is itself a family business that grapples with the same challenges shared by all family businesses, things like succession planning, tax and liquidity concerns, governance control issues, and preparing for the next generation of leadership. Yeah. Alvina, do you mind expanding on how this closely knit network of family businesses that make up the multi-billion dollar industry that is the NFL operate, and what advisors and clients can learn from how they tackle the same issues that smaller family businesses face?
Yeah, sure. So this is very interesting because you're right. We're not talking about a single celebrity, but at the same time, the collective is ginormous. Right, the NFL together each year produce about $200 billion in revenue. And so the collective impact it has and how public it is something that I think we can all learn from in terms of applying it to our clients, individual clients that are family business. I also think that, you know, given the enormous support and popularity of football in America, you know, these owners are celebrities in their own right,
in their
local town. And we do indeed also have some former players who are in there. So, you know, just to frame the conversation a little bit, David, right? To me, the NFL, it is more than just a very successful family business. I think it's actually a collective of a family business, meaning I watch it and I think it's more akin to a family that has multi-branches, you know, along generations. So not only do we have to worry about all the things we normally worry about with clients when it relates to their individual family, their nuclear family, we also need to think about how this applies to the extended family. And the reason I say this is the NFL has 32 teams, okay? And each franchise is owned by, you know, a family or a bunch of people, let's just say, right? Eight of those teams are actually owned by their founding families through multiple generations. And it's an aging family. The average age of a principal owner of each of the team is 72. Seven of them are actually over the age of 80. Their value is incredible, right? The average team value of the of an NFL team, obviously they vary, but the average team value is $5 billion. And with 32 teams, you are talking about a collective of about $160 billion. And I think,
the Washington Commanders were the last team to sell like last year, and it was $6 billion thereabouts.
Yes, exactly. And if you look at even the trajectory of growth, which is what's actually fueling a lot of these kind of succession issue right now, is not only how much it is, but how quickly it grew, right? So according to a recent Washington Post article that I read, the average franchise ownership or the value had grew 69% from 2020 to 2023, right? So if you think about that, that is, and according to this article, it has gone up even more than the stock price and home prices since 2014. And because of that, it creates a lot of liquidity issue, succession planning issue, governance, you know, something you alluded to that we're, you know, I'm happy to kind of go through, you know, have a deeper conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think just to quickly sort of explain, the NFL has a number of rules in place that have sort of maintained
Yes.
this sort of family business collective. There is, of course, the one famous outlier of the Green Bay Packers. It's the only publicly owned team in any major American sport. So we're going to put them for the moment to the side and talk about the 31 teams. But the rules that apply to them, the non-grandfathered Packers rules, I believe require at least one owner to have 30% minimum of the shares. They allow a group to buy a team, but one person has to have at least 30%. They want, I guess, the buck to stop with somebody. And then they
Yes.
limit the size of that group to 32 people.
That's right. So it used to be higher than that. It used to be over 51%. Then over the years, they've cut it down to 30% in 1985 for ownership groups. But even within that ownership group, it has to be led by a single controlling owner. The other interesting development that it had is that in 2015, they started to allow the NFL started to allow trust ownership. So that it's no longer just individual owning it, which helped a lot, you know, when it comes to succession and estate planning. But even with that, there are certain rules within that of what that is. The other thing that they require, which I think is, I guess, pretty, it's necessary, you know, for a family collective like this, is that each team has to have a succession plan that is affirmed and amended each year that is filed with the league. And I think what is the really interesting development right now is that last year, there is a working group of five owners that has been convened in order, it's they called it like a special committee, where they are to consider whether they're going to allow private equity as a general matter to the league. And interestingly enough, Clark Hunt, who is the owner and chairman of the Kansas City Chiefs, who won the Super Bowl, is on the committee, and he is also the chairman of the NFL Finance Committee. And as recent as yesterday, the day of this recording, it's March 14th, I read in a news outlet, Sports Business Journal, that because they're meeting, they recently met this committee. And according to this article, who has some inside sources, it says that it sounds like there's going to be some kind of framework to allow private equity in, and that there will likely come to a full vote later this month. Again, this is according to this, you know, latest news outlet. But I do think that because of the challenges that it faces, you know, that any business, family business face, but for the NFL, it's just, you know, times 10, right? Because of the size and the magnitude and the publicity. This is something that's a very recent development that they really need to look into.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, with the values of teams exploding the way that they have and only increasing, if we're talking about $6 billion, it's awful hard. The number of potential buyers who can pony up 30% of 6 billion, that's a vanishingly small number at this point, unless you allow sort of more complex ownership structures, let's say.
Yes, exactly right, right? Because at that number, you know, despite how there are, you know, many billionaires in the world, there's a shrinking pool of people who can afford this, right? So therefore, allowing, you know, institutional funds like private equity fund or even sovereign fund is almost necessary, you know, for people to have the liquidity that they need. Interestingly enough, you know, other sports franchise like the NBA, the MLB, they've all, you know, throughout the years have started to allow this. So, you know, be curious to see if the NFL will be, you know, kind of the last man standing and the latest holdout, and they will indeed also go in that direction.
So I've pulled us a little bit ahead of ourselves here, but let's sort of take a step back, like you mentioned, and sort of look at how sort of what are these some of these issues that you're having? Obviously, the large concentrated asset that is a NFL franchise in sort of a family portfolio. What are some of the issues that brings up in terms of just managing it and passing it on and those sorts of things.
So I'll start with I think what is the most immediate issue, and this is something I see in our clients too when it comes to family-owned business, and it's liquidity. Liquidity from a current capital standpoint and liquidity from a succession estate planning standpoint. So let me go into that a little bit more. Liquidity in the current standpoint, by that I mean with the rising cost and inflation, right? With credit getting really harder these days with the high interest rates, a lot of family businesses is having a hard time getting the liquidity they need to operate the business and continue to expand, despite how valuable the valuation is. Right. And this is no different for the NFL. I mean, if you look at, let's just take the Super Bowl, right? We just started talking about this. If you look at the Super Bowl, right, the last stadium cost, right, was enormous to build the stadium with the increasing rate of labor, right? Increasing cost of materials, right? So all of these teams need to raise, continue to raise current capital, right, in order to continue to expand the business. Now, assuming that the business is expanding and the valuation continue goes up, which it has, then they have to think about liquidity as it relates to transition. Because as we all know, right, when someone passes, an owner passes, his or her interest in the team is includable in their estate unless they've done some estate planning upfront, which we'll talk about later. There is going to be a massive, massive estate tax due upon the death of some of these owners. And again, remember, the average age of the principal owner is 72, right? So this is coming. And so, how do we, how, look, and the normal things you do, to kind of take care of some liquidity issues for a lot of business owner is in life insurance, for example, doing some gifting pre-death. But if you think about just the sheer size of the value, right? I mean, can you really get insurance in the billions? Right?
Who's
Can you
covering
really
this?
gift that much, right?
How
Now
many
they
levels of reinsurance can you get on something?
exactly, right? And also, now, arguably, I do think that, you have to kind of look at each person's individual estate plan, but they might qualify for the 6166 deferred tax, right? Under those rules, because it is a family and small, it's not small business, a family
Do you mind
business.
just quickly explaining what that is? I'll be in it for our
Oh,
non.
sure. Yes, of course. Sorry. So yeah, under Internal Revenue Code 6166, if you meet certain requirements, the IRS will allow you to defer, not pay, but defer your estate tax, which normally is due 9 months after the date of death or on the alternate valuation day. It will allow you to defer up to 10 years, right? So for a lot of family businesses where the business does not have the liquidity to pay, the IRS, the government essentially do not want to force businesses to have to go to a fire sale, assuming that's even possible, right? To have to pay off the bill. So therefore, under Section 6166, the estate can defer the estate tax up to 10 years. You have to pay the requisite interest to the IRS. But all this does is really kind of defer you a little bit of time in order to smooth it out. But again, here we are talking about the average team value at $5 billion, even at a 10-year deferred tax rate, right? You still have to pay the tax at some point. So I think, like, in the typical things you do, right, with business owners and the liquidity crunch when it comes to estate planning, right? So the life insurance, gifting, 6166 protection, getting a Gwagin loan, for example, like all those are possible, but at the sheer scale we're talking about, you're not going to have a one size fit all situation.
And it's really interesting. Like, no matter how good an estate planner is, when you're dealing with a $6 billion asset, there's like they're not magicians. Like, there's only so much, so many
Exactly.
knobs to turn. But it's also one of those interesting things where it does. I mean, for it can give you enough rope to hang yourself if you want to get too clever. I remember it was probably 10 years ago now when John Davidson died. He was the owner of both the Tampa Bay Lightning and the Detroit Red Wings, so two huge franchises. And he tried to get really clever in his estate plan with some self-canceling installment notes to really knock things down. And depending on how deep in the estate planning weeds you are, what they did was either innovative or sketchy, depending on how you feel about it. But they tried to get creative, let's say,
Yes, yes.
and they end up getting hit by a huge hundreds of million dollar tax bill. and lost a major case. So, with it's these interesting things where there's a lot of room for planning, but there's also a lot of room to hang yourself if you're trying to get too cute.
Right. And the thing is, they are incredibly public, right?
Yeah.
So you better believe that
Yeah.
there is going to be an audit of some sort,
Yeah,
right? Like
the
this.
IRS isn't letting that $6 billion asset slip
Well,
through without taking
exactly.
a quick glance at what's going on.
Yeah, like this is not something that you say, you know, that you hope can kind of fly under the radar, right? Given the amount and also how public these things are. And also, even if there isn't, say, a tax issue, because, you know, there are have been examples where it's been left to charity. So, for example, for the Seattle Seahawks, right, Paul Allen's estate, when he died in 2018, his sister Jody Allen took over, and his will actually left instruction, according to reports, to say that they want to sell the team and distribute the proceeds in charity. Now, I don't know the specific of Mr. Allen's estate, but if you kind of look at those facts, right, or as it's reported, you would think, oh, okay, great. There's no estate tax due because you are leaving it to charity. However, the problem there is the NBA bylaws dictate that these estate held teams need to be sold at a quote reasonable time. To my knowledge, you know, sitting here in 2024, it still hasn't been sold and the proceeds still hasn't been distributed to charity. So even if you have like a very simple plan that says, okay, you know what, I'm not even worried about it. I, you know, forget the issues of my family and whether they're going to succeed. I'm just going to give it all away. It's still not that simple, given again the rules around the NFL as a collective and also the sheer size of what we're talking about.
And that sort of ties back into your sort of an explanation, just concept of it as one huge family business, right? Where, Paul Allen is just one small branch of it trying to make a plan, but then, the rest of the league, the other families in the big family business, all have a say in a way over how that can happen and sort of what must happen. So
That's
it's
right.
almost like you have like 32 cooks in the kitchen in what is already an extremely difficult process with a huge asset.
That's right. That's right. So, in fact, let me see if I can remember. There was another one where the league actually came back and said, no, you are not allowed to do that. Let me see if I can look at my notes and figure out which one. Oh, this is right. It's the New Orleans Saints. That's what it was. So in the New Orleans Saints, Gail Benson, who is now the third wife of Tom Benson, who was the owner, she inherited from him. And she again already said that it's going to be sold when she dies, right? But here there were already some past issue because of the family dynamics, because the children of Tom Benson doesn't get along with Mrs. Benson, who again is the third wife.
Tale as old as time,
Yeah, exactly.
yeah.
And so there has been a very, very public, you know, kind of a sequence where at first, you know, the children were written out of the will, and then there's been lawsuit to claim that, you know, maybe Mr. Benson was mentally unfit to make decisions, and the parties ultimately ended up settling this out of court. For every family business, right, the family is the business and the business is the family. So navigating through these dynamics, right, oftentimes with a second or third spouse or, you know, family members who might be in the business and some others who might not be in the business is going to be very difficult for the NFL families.
I think the visibility you mentioned is a huge part of that, right? Where, when you're trying to prepare, maybe, you don't want to sell the business, but you have just the next generation of the family that, are going to go through a more sort of traditional succession process. You
That's
know,
right.
like in a normal business, you would have them presumably work in lower parts of the business or behind the scenes in higher parts to sort of like shadow people and find things out. But, in the
Yes.
NFL, where everything is public and everyone knows who these owners are, and they're parts of the community is very invested. Let's say the fans are over invested a little bit. Fan is short for fanatic, right? So you have these kids who are sort of trying to learn on the job while everyone knows they're next in line and everyone knows, is sort of critiquing them before they're even remotely ready, for the spotlight.
Yeah, that's right. And then on top of all that, you have these kind of extended family that have rules that basically say, no, you know, you might not actually be able to do what you already all agreed to. So the other example is the Tennessee Titans, right? Bud Adams' team, right? He actually left his shares, according to news outlet, left his shares in the holding company with very detailed bylaws that require his three children to reach consensus on any major decision surrounding the team. So basically, you need a supermajority. Right. Supposedly, this was done with the complete knowledge and buy-in with all his three kids. And so you would think that, wow, this is like a textbook example of actually how it worked, right? While the parent is alive, he worked this through with his children and everybody has buy-in. But no, the league came back and said, no, actually that structure violate the league's bylaws. And then they got fined over it actually. But my understanding, and again, according to what you can glean from the news, because a lot of these obviously are very private, is that that remains unchanged, right, in terms of the bylaws. And then in 2019, just a couple of years past, right, one of the kids actually announced that she was going to put up her share for sale. Now, at the time, her share was worth $700 million. Tell me, who would pay $700 million to go into a effectively a family business with extended, you know, let's just say aunts, uncles, so to speak, right? Or great aunts and uncles, who is going to control what you can and cannot do with your $700 million investments?
It's somebody else's family, basically, right? Yeah.
That's right. Now, what's interesting now is with private equity, that I think is going to change the dynamics completely, right? Because you think about the NFL. In addition, they have had instances of outside investor, right, where were not one of their founding members or extended family of a founding member. However, if you think about all those buyers, they've all been individuals who are either, you know, friends with the family, or like local major fans, or maybe even former players, right? So they're kind of like friends and family. That is very different than having an owner that is an institution. Right, a firm, a private equity firm, who's you know maybe whoever is control of the firm at the time, maybe a big fan of the team, right, and have a personal interest. But at the end of the day, a private equity firm is there to do what? To return their investment to their investors of their fund. So while I am sure that everybody in the NFL is there to make money, right? I mean, it is a business. The additional lens of private equity and their guiding principles and what is their primary goal, plus their responsibility to their fund investor, is going to really change the dynamics.
Yeah, it's interesting, give and take, right? Where right now, you know, there's a responsibility to the fans in a way, right? That's because, you know, a lot of these sports teams, you know, before the sort of recent, you know, sports teams have always made money, but I think in the last sort of 25 years, we've seen, as you've mentioned, that the amount of money they make completely explode, you know, with TV deals and those sorts of things, and just sort of the internationalization of everything. But, you know, so previously, you would buy, you know, a very wealthy person would largely buy a sports team as a status symbol. It would be in addition to their other business that they made all their money with a lot of the
That's
time. You
right.
know, like I think Jimmy Haslam, the owner of the Browns, owns, you know, trucking companies. They all made their money elsewhere and they have that business. And then this is like my toy that shows how rich I am and lets me like play with this because it's fun. And so the idea of, you know, something as cutthroat, you know, the reputation of a private equity firm that's going to come in and sort of strip something down to the bone and try to have a liquidity event. Versus that idea of I bought this as a badge to play with is so incongruous as to almost be like hard to fathom.
Yeah, exactly right. And there's case in point to prove, right? Carolina Panthers, David Tepper, the hedge fund founder, bought it in 2018 for $2 billion. Since then, there's been major cultural clash between his style and how the team has ran, right? He's fired multiple coaches and is very hands-on. Even if you think about the culture of a stereotypical private equity firm and what they do, versus the culture of a really, you know, a family business, right? And a lot of them are in smaller towns, right? Where they are the community and they are the town. It is just setting up, like you said, a complete culture clash.
The idea that private equity is somehow even more go-go macho than the NFL is pretty hilarious to me.
Indeed, indeed. You know, and then David, the other thing I think about too is, you know, let's like, you know, we talked a lot about, you know, the governance and the culture, but I also think like inherently the institutions are different from individuals. Meaning, if you're a private equity firm, right, you might, and I don't know this, you know, how this would apply in this case, but I just think about it. They, in addition to responsibility to the fund investor, they might also have certain financial disclosure requirements. Right. And historically, the NFL, you know, very detail of the running of the NFL is it's private, right? These things are not in the public eye. And I would imagine that the owners of the teams want to keep it that way, right? And then if you think about it, like what if the private equity firm, goes bankrupt? Like, they have multiple funds, right? What if something happened and one fund really drags them down? And we've seen this happen, right? Despite how successful a lot of these firms are, and they have to be in order to obviously, kind of look into this dollar amount. But, things have happened. And so, if they end up, going bankrupt, or these institutions end up maybe getting sued for something else because they are running a big business in addition to this, that could really impact and drag the rest of the teams and the rest of the league into it. Definitely, definitely in the public eye. Now, I'm not saying that individuals can't, right? So, for example, like Mark Cuban, right? Like, if his individual businesses were to get sued, or he's has something, that he has disclosure, like individuals still have the same issue. But I do feel that when you're an institution, you are subject to a much stricter set of rules. There's a lot less wiggle room, right? Because you are an institution as opposed to an individual.
And it's really like to bring the scale back down to sort of the similar question to, bring an outsider into the family business, right? Where, you need
Exactly.
the capital they can provide, but in addition to the culture, I mean, what sort of, sh or what are they subject to? You brought an institution into the family business. Well, now everything's gonna have to change, right? Because it's not, for these same reasons, this is something that could happen on a much smaller scale than the private equity scale necessarily.
Yes. And we see this in our clients all the time, right? When you get a third party investor, right, that isn't long known to the family or even the employees of the family, you are, despite the fact that it might make really sound business judgment to have them because of the liquidity that's provided, it really throws kind of the culture into imbalance. It creates a lot of tension, possibly amongst the current owners, the current family members, and also employees, because everybody's going to be like, okay, wait, hold on. We kind of know how things are going to go, right, with the current owners, because we've seen the children grow up, coming to the box, watching the team. A lot of them worked in the business, so they kind of know who they are and what they are. And they're all from, a lot of these teams are from the same time. They live there, like this is literally their whole entire ecosystem, right, in that world. Now all of a sudden you're going to get private equity, outside people who are from an entirely different ecosystem. What is that going to mean? Kind of navigating through that is going to be really important. Now, according to this latest article that I saw about, this kind of group right now talking about, possibly allowing private equity in, it did say that it seemed like it's not going to be a free fall, in the sense that it is going to have a very prescriptive rules as to, which firms could bid, so they're obviously controlling the quality of the firms, and also how much percentage they can own. In each team, and also across the teams. Like, let's just say you have a private equity firm that owns multiple teams, right? So it does seem to me that the NFL is going to be like kind of recognize all these issues, obviously, and are going to be very prescriptive and put up guardrails as to what this might mean, and kind of try to limit this, to maybe just an equity infusion right now, as opposed to, I'm sorry, a credit or cash infusion, as opposed to truly turning over culture and truly turning over ownership.
Yeah,
And
interesting.
indeed, for our business owner clients, again, taking the scale back down a little bit, right? For a lot of our business owner clients, that's how it starts, right? You kind of start small, see how this is going to go, right, before you do a full transition.
And just and we've sort of been stressing how sort of tight-knit and sort of incestuous all this is. And it's just as like a fun fact example, the Rooney family founded the Steelers, and the Mara family founded the Giants. So the actress Rooney Mara is so named because her grandfather founded the Giants and her grandmother was part of the family that founded the Steelers. So not only are those individual family businesses owned by families, they're family with each other.
Exactly. Isn't she the person who was, what did she do? She was like the
She's
girl.
the girl with the dragon tattoo, I
That's
think.
right.
I mean,
That's right.
she's
That's
done
right.
plenty
Because I,
since, I'm sure, but I think that's what people would
yeah,
know her
that's
for.
right. That's right, because I remember reading that, and so, like, but this just kind of goes back, David, right, to the point we talked about at the earlier the conversation, which is, this is not just a family business. It is an extended family business. I mean, if you think about it, like, this is like, kind of back in the day where you have one person kind of marrying their second cousin once removed,
Yeah,
right?
this is
Because like
dynastic in a way,
this is
right? It's like,
dynastic,
monarch, it's
exactly.
like a monarchy.
Yeah, they grew up together, right? They socialized together. They literally played together, right? Like on
Yeah.
these big stage. And but they know what to expect because they're all in the same club, quote unquote. Right? You know what you're gonna expect when you sell a small fraction, say to a, a friend of your the patriarch for a very, very long time. Because likely they've came to the games and have been involved for a long time. Or you sell to a a former player who's on the team, right? There's some of that too. You know what they're gonna be like because they have history with it, with you and your family and the business. Not so much for external private equity.
Interesting. I know something you mentioned much earlier in the conversation as we've sort of come towards the end here, but you mentioned that, we've been focusing on the potential for private equity that they're discussing. But you also mentioned that they have sort of fairly recently allowed trust ownership.
Yes.
How does that factor into everything? Does that versus, the more traditional structures, does that change a lot of these, any of these challenges or succession issues, or just have its own issues?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. I'm glad we brought it back up to the trust. So look, I think that when you have a trust owning it, you now bring into all the other fiduciary issues that a trustee and beneficiaries will have, right? And now you're just even adding more complexity to it. And look, of course, it totally makes sense for a lot of these teams to be owning these things through trust, for privacy reasons and for, kind of estate planning or gift tax planning reasons. But I do think now you're throwing in even more players into, pardon the pun, and more players into the equation because now you have trustees, right? Who may or may not be family members, and you now have beneficiaries. So you insert all your typical kind of, fiduciary drama, right? Beneficiaries who feel like they're not getting the distribution or they don't have a say at the table. Trustee who are bound by their fiduciary duty to not only look at the best interest of the current beneficiary, but also the remainderment that might be there for generations to come. Right. So, and then of course, also you look at also incentive language that often caused issues for businesses or assets that are owned by trusts. Right. They're very well-meaning, but oftentimes it can create issues. So, for example, actually, I actually have an example. Denver's Broncos. Okay. Pat Bowlen was the owner, and he's always said that he wanted the business to or the Broncos to remain in his family for all his seven kids. Okay. So in 2014. He actually ceded the day-to-day operation to Joe Ellis, who was the then CEO of the Broncos, right? Who was not a part of the family. He then put the team into a trust, and there was language in the trust to say which of his seven children will end up leading. Okay. He had Ellis, who was again the CEO of the Broncos. He had his attorney, the team counsel, Rich Silveca, I think was his name, and also his family law attorney, Mary Kelly. They became the trustee and were the ones who are supposed to make this determination. As in determination based on the language of the trust, how which child is to lead, right? So look, on its face, he did absolutely the right thing. He was very, kind of focused on it, very transparent. All his kids are involved. He named his long-term trusted business employee, right? The CEO of the business that's been running the business and all the attorneys who drafted the agreement, right, to be involved. But then what happened is in the trust language, right, it was really vague as to what that means, right? To have the right stuff basically to lead. So it was words like leadership, sound judgment, having an advanced degree, right? 5 years of senior management. And again, very, very thoughtful, very thoughtful. And then over the years, right, people started jockeying us to say, well, what does that really mean, right? How many times have we had trust beneficiaries say, looking at the language of the trust or even looking at a side letter that a grantor creates and be like, well, mom and dad said, why aren't you giving me XYZ? Right. And then the trustee has to come in and make a judgment to say, like, yeah, I know that's what the word says, but that's not what this really mean. Or in our interpretation of it, it means something different. So in this particular example, that's exactly what happened. So one of the children, Beth Bowen, right, took her case very public, and she had earned a law degree. She's completed requirements, laid out by this, and actually took down an ad. I don't know if it was an op-ed or an ad, something that basically said, well, I should lead it because I met all the requirements. And then the trustee subsequently issued a very brief statement that basically say, no, we do not believe so. She's not capable. What ends up happening to the Broncos? Bob Walton, Walmart, right, led a group that bought it for $4.6 billion some years later. So here, you know, I don't know that there's actually a magic solution for any of this, because even when you do have a very thoughtful owner with the
Intentional, yeah.
right counsel, right, very, very intentional, you know, putting it into you know, the language, you know, it still didn't, you know, do what it is supposed to. So, you know, to me, this just go back to actually what I always say to clients, right? Like, look, and I say this as a former practicing trust and estates lawyer, right? Like, look, your lawyers and the trust language, it's here for guidelines and for almost like guardrails. But at the end of the day, they are not the structure you put in, the language you put in is never gonna be the thing that solves it all. What you need, and you absolutely need, is communication and family communication. Because you need to do that while you're alive to even have a
Yeah.
shot. If you do not build a healthy and functioning family, and in this case, 32 extended family, you're not even gonna have a chance. Because you can put in the structure all you want, but when there's a will, there's a way, and there is a way to circumvent, interpret to each own perspective or priority at the moment, and it will lead to infighting no matter what.
This is actually a great place to wrap up, because we brought it back to communication, and I've joked on like past episodes that like every episode of this show could just me be saying communication. That's what works. That's what you got to do, because it ends up no matter what topic in estate planning we're talking about or any kind of planning, communication is always like, oh, and then, oh, of course, communication is the most important thing. So like this could just be called the
Well, because
communication podcast,
people,
but it's
yeah,
true.
because
It's silly, but it's true, and that's the thing behind what you said is 9 times out of 10. It's so much better to do these things when people are alive. Making these transfers during life, making these plans during life is so much more effective and so much more, I mean, nothing guaranteed, but much more guaranteed to get the result that resembles what you want when the parties are all
that's right.
there, as opposed to having one party
A hundred
being a
percent.
magic ghost that everyone's trying to like argue the intent of. It's like, it's like trying to argue what the dog is thinking.
Right, exactly. Look, at the end of the day, it's people, and people is communication. At the end of the day, estate planning is a people business, right? And now we're just in a people business that happens to have $200 million,
Yeah.
$200 billion, sorry, excuse me, in
Yeah,
revenue each
$200
year.
billion dollar
But
people
it
business,
is,
yeah.
exactly, but it is a it's a people business, and now you have additional people in play, private equity. So this is going to be very interesting. I am keeping my eye out, David, you know, for whatever might go to this vote. I'm sure we're going to hear more about it, you know, as this issue progresses. But it really, I do really feel like it is ripe right now for some kind of bold move that's going to move the league from a 32 family business, right, onto the next stage.
Interesting. Yeah. I think what I saw in articles was that by the end of March is their hope. But we'll
Yes,
see
that's what I saw
if
too.
that actually works out.
Yep, that is what I saw as well. Yep.
And that is all the time we've had for today. That I think this was a really interesting sort of long-ranging conversation. I'd like to thank Alvina Lowe for, walking us through this and sort of tackling a very big topic with us and in an understandable way. Thanks so much for coming on, Alvina.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. Appreciate the opportunity.
And for all our listeners, I'll see you, or I guess you'll hear me, on the next episode of Celebrity Estates, Wills of the Rich and Famous.
Thank you for listening to the Celebrity Estates Wills of the Rich and Famous podcast. Click the subscribe button below to become notified when new episodes become available. The information covered and posted represents the views and opinions of the guest and does not necessarily represent the views or opinions of InformaWealthManagement.com. The content has been made available for informational and educational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional investing advice. Always seek the advice of your financial advisor or other qualified financial service provider with any questions you may have regarding your investment planning.